You are listening to The Private Citizen, a civil liberties podcast. This is episode 157 for Wednesday, the 13th of September, 2023. When well-meaning people make the laws. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Yes, I'm here. I'm back. I'll get into what's going on in a moment. But thank you. Thank you for listening to the show. And thanks everybody who's supporting the show. I want to do that, say that at the very beginning, because it's very important to me. And my name is Fab. I'm your host, coming live to you from Düsseldorf in Germany on the beautiful River Rhine. I say live because I'm live streaming this on Twitch. I nearly said live twitching this on stream. I haven't done this in a while. Yes, I'm live streaming this, which, you know, you can check out on Twitch when I do it. Or if you go to the show notes at privatecitizen.press, there's a link. There's a YouTube. This is confusing, but I archive all the the streams on YouTube. So there's a YouTube playlist if you want to see how the sausage is made. I don't know why you would want that, but that is certainly a thing you can do if you want to. Anyway, let's talk about what's been going on. Well, life has been happening. I talked about this before. I'm not going to get into this a lot. All I'm going to say is things have been happening. If you're interested in what has been happening, I wrote a blog post about this. So if you go to privatecitizen.press, the show notes for this episode 157, there is all the links, including a link to this blog post where I talk about turning 40 and what it means. And I kind of reflect on what happened this year, which is kind of impacts, you know, kind of intersects with, you know, why I haven't been podcasting so much. But really, why is not important? The solution is important. Hopefully the solution. As you can tell, today is Wednesday. I'm trying to get this train back on the road and going forward, release an episode every Wednesday. There will be exceptions to that, of course, but I'm generally trying, right? That is the attempt. We will see how well that goes, but that is what I'm trying to do. And if you're interested in the blog post I wrote, with that came a very interesting discussion on the forum, because I've typed the forum in as a comment kind of function for my blog and also this podcast. So it's embedded, a forum thread is embedded at the end of this, of every podcast episode, and also on my blog posts. And we had a very interesting discussion. Yevgeny Kuznetsov chimed in with his own reflections on being 40 and what he thinks that means and what changed in his life and whatever. And I think that's very interesting. So, you know, you can check that out if you want. To give you a quick, the gist of what happened is, it's really, for me, I don't think has anything to do with being 40. It's just some things changed in my life recently, which basically meant that I'm doing more exercise and I'm becoming, for some reason that I would have never, like a year ago, if you told me that. So today I'm actually taking a day off exercise, but until yesterday, which was the 12th of September, I did sports every day this month. And so I'm becoming addicted to sports, which is ludicrous because I hate exercise, really, or I used to. but it's had a very good effect on me, how I feel. And it's something, actually, I've noticed that a good friend of mine, Dave Megaslippers, posted on his blog. He posted a book review, and he talked about this book, which was also about exercise. And apparently in this book, they talk about how the school system ruins exercise for everybody. You know, the idea of of exercising, and that happened to me as well, which I've thought was interesting. But you know, I don't want to give it up. So I've had this, I've had that, and then I've also had, I'm doing more things with friends recently, or you know, started last year as well, whatever. And so stuff is cutting into my, into the time I have, which has had a very, like, spending more time with friends and exercising more has had a very good effect on myself, like on how I feel. And so I didn't want to cut down on that, which caused the general problem, you know, that I don't have much time, which also impacted my podcasts, my podcasting. It's not really that, and the thing I think I've noticed or I've realized is that it's not the time, right? I'm not missing. So the time, the exercise, and spending time with friends takes out of my week, basically, is not like, doesn't leave me so much free time that I couldn't do a podcast. The problem is more the scheduling, you know, doing exercise every day and scheduling that with my day job and my, you know, when I have jobs as a freelance journalist. That's kind of what cuts into it. And so I've basically realized I need to get back to this for this podcast. I think the solution is getting back to this, like, once a week, like having a fixed block in my schedule where I produce the podcast. And it turns out that Wednesday is just the perfect day for me somehow to do this. So I'm trying to get back to it. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. I didn't really want to get into that so long. So let's get the show on the road and let's talk about the topic, you know, that I want to talk about, that this show is actually about, which is some child pornography laws in Germany that's, you know, they're not really new. They came into effect a few years ago. But what they have done and what it means for, like, society at large. So that's the topic. And yeah, we're gonna talk about that now. As you can tell, I need to do this more often. I'm totally out of practice. But so basically, this is a German topic, but I want to break it down or kind of get a bird's eye view of it that illustrates a larger problem that I've talked about before, but that this exemplifies very well. And I think that's applicable to you, even if you're probably not in Germany as you listen to this. But, you know, so this is not only German laws, German laws and German news. I think this is also very applicable to everybody out there. Because I think it's what has caused this is something that's been happening. It's been happening in our society. And by that, I mean like the society of Western democracies at large. You know, I think similar problems, even if the laws aren't the same, but similar problems are happening in the UK, in the US, probably in Australia and in other countries. So I think this is interesting for people outside of Germany. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking about this on this podcast. And before we get into the topic, there's also something else I want to say. So we're going to, this podcast, this episode is going to deal about with laws about child pornography. Now, I want to make something very clear. Do not misunderstand me. I do think that there have to be laws against child pornography. And I'm not against abolishing these laws. I'm not in favor of making any kind of child pornography or child abuse legal. I do look at this issue different than many other people, I feel, because I don't have kids and I don't intend to have kids. So I think sometimes I look at this, I feel, more objectively than people who are parents or who, you know, are thinking there might be parents one day and are thinking about that in these kind of terms. I just don't see these things emotionally or as emotionally as other people because I do not have kids. Pretty much these laws, aside from my professional life, which we might get into, which I might talk about as part of this episode as well, but like aside from there, You know, for example, child pornography is always used in, as an excuse to pass all kinds of laws that impinge on people's privacy on the internet. Therefore, this always comes in when I write about professionally, you know, write about privacy or IT security and stuff like that. But other than that, these laws just simply don't affect me because I do not have any kids, and I am not, you know, I'm not aroused by child pornography. It's not a thing that I would ever, you know, get in contact with, aside from, you know, my personal life, right? I don't know anybody who's, as far as I know, who is into this kind of thing, and I don't have any kids. So I'm this is a topic that I just see very unemotionally from a perspective of just the society at large, which is, I think, why I see it different than other people. But also, I think sometimes, you know, better because I'm not emotionally invested. And the reason, for example, why I think that there have to be laws against this kind of thing is simply that it is obvious to me that most of society wants this. Right, I personally, because I do not have any, in German we say Berührungspunkte, any contact points. Like these kind of laws do not affect me at all. I don't really care one way or the other, to be honest. But obviously, most people are parents and feel very strongly about this, including my own parents, for example. Which is obvious, you know, when you talk to people. So it's obviously something that most society feels very strongly about. So, you know, so I feel like, you know, from a purely somebody, as somebody who's studied history and politics and how laws come about and what laws are supposed to do, for me, this is a very logical. I mean, this is what laws are meant to do, right? They are meant to codify something that society wants at large, once codified, even if it doesn't affect you personally, it is something that is probably for the better of all society. Anyway, I just wanted to say that before we get into the topic so that there are completely no misunderstandings, because, you know, I'm putting this out on the internet and misunderstandings seem to be the norm on the internet. So I kind of wanted to get ahead of that. And I kind of want to explain my stance on this, right? Because obviously it is a very special or a stance that not many people have, because I think I am clearly in the minority in society as somebody who doesn't have kids and doesn't want to have kids. I think that is clearly a minority of people. So it's a special perspective. So I just wanted to make that clear. Now, why are we talking about this? As I said, to me, this is always, you know, child pornography, or as they like to call it these days, CSAM, which stands for child sexual abuse material. I'm just going to keep calling it child pornography because CSAM just sounds... I think they use terms like that to make it more abstract. The people, especially the people who want to pass these laws under an umbrella of protecting against, you know, fighting against child pornography, but are really not concerned with that. They're more concerned with, you know, invading your privacy, basically. You know, that's why they use terms like that. I'm going to call it what it is, what most people understand what it is. So I'm just going to call it child pornography. And that's why I'm, you know, mostly impacted by this. Because whenever there's somebody who wants mass data retention or wants to sidestep cryptography on the side of law enforcement, they always say, we do this because we want to catch people who are distributing child pornography. I think often this is not actually the case. Often this is just a way to make just investigating things for the police easier. And I've talked about this on this podcast and on other podcasts often, because it's just such a blanket, because everybody agrees with that, right? Nobody can say, you know, when they say this in an arena like the parliament or even on TV, nobody in the audience or from any other party can say, yeah, but, you know, I am against this. And then what you're against, fighting child pornography? And then you have to explain, no, I'm against you know, whatever you're doing, like the end doesn't justify the means, which gets into the weeds, which is a good thing for the people who want to pass these laws or whatever, because they have a very easy message. They're like, we're fighting the evil guys, and if you are against us, you're for the evil guys. And they then put you, who's against actually their methods, maybe not their end, you know, the end they're trying to reach, but the methods, they're putting you into a very hard position where you have to explain in detail and in nuance, like, why you are against this law, even though you are for the fight against child pornography, right? Which puts you in a bad decision. Some feedback. I didn't see this because, you know, live feedback on Twitch. Indie GamieX actually saying, hey, Indie GamieX, supporter of the show. We go swimming in the sea every day now, and it gives me such a mental boost. You know, referring to me earlier, talking about exercise every day. Yeah, I wish I could go swimming in the sea every day. Although, in the winter, I don't know if I'm a fan of that, but, you know, it floats you. But I'm quite envious that you can go swimming in the sea, though. Yeah, I also feel like people say they have more energy at work when they do exercise. I don't really feel that, because I always have enough energy at work. But I feel it clears my brain, especially if I get very angry about things or I get frustrated. I go bouldering a little bit, and then, you know, I feel better. And I already miss it. I didn't do it today, and I miss it. And the reason why I didn't do it is because my neck muscles are just fucked, because I did way too much exercise. So my body's definitely telling me, like, if you touch your shoulder muscles, if you just touch them and they hurt, you know, your body's definitely telling you to take a break. So that's what I'm doing today. But anyway, to get back to the topic, yeah. So you know, so that's why people do that, right? This child pornography cause is a very easy cause to get whatever you wanna get done, because it's very hard to object against that, and that's why it's such a. I think the actual fight against child pornography is suffering from this, suffering from people using it as a shield for all kinds of different other things. But anyway, why we're talking about this? So in the year 2021, so a few years ago, the German government, which at the time was like the Grand Coalition, CDU-SPD, a Grand Coalition, they decided they want to change the criminal code to make to have much stricter penalties and much stricter prosecution for people who are caught in the possession of child porn material. Now, the umbrella under which I'm talking about is, I've often said on this show, and I've said this in other places as well, that I think, you know, people think the biggest threat to our society is like climate change or, you know, for a while it was like SARS-CoV-2 or whatever. You know, or maybe the Russians. I think the biggest threat to our society today, and I do strongly believe this, I used to think that the most evil force in human history, or, you know, at any given time, was organized religion, which I think is still up there. But, you know, it's, you know, Christianity has mellowed down a bit, you know, these days it's pretty much Islam and, you know, Christian sects that are doing bad things. But, you know, religion is still up there. But I think these days, actually, the most dangerous, biggest threat to our society are people who mean well, but have no idea what they're doing. In German, we have this term that when you use that, people get angry at you. But I still think it's a good term. It's called Gutmenschen, a good human, like goody-two-shoes, right? People who want to do the right thing. And this is why when you use that term as like a derogative term, people get mad at you, because they're like, these people want to do the right thing. And I always point out that doing the right thing is nice, but it doesn't get you anywhere. Like, wanting to do the right thing is really not good at all. You have to actually do the right thing, right? Just wanting to do something, you know, but not actually doing it is probably worse. Or what's worse is you're trying to do the right thing, but you have no idea what you're doing, and you're actually doing something that makes everything much worse. Which this is okay. Like there was good intent behind this move to make the criminal code in Germany stricter, but it turned out to be a catastrophe because the people who did it were idiots. They weren't thinking clear, right? They were thinking emotionally. They weren't thinking far enough, and they didn't listen to the people who knew better. So what they did is basically they made the possession of child pornography. Obviously, I'm not a legal expert, right? Another thing I have to say up front, I'm not a legal expert. I hope that's obvious. If you're watching the live recording or the live stream of the recording of that, you will undoubtedly tell by my visuals that I'm not a legal expert. But, you know, if you're listening in podcast form, please take my word for it. I'm not a legal expert. But as far as I understand it, what they did is they changed the law so that possession would always be a crime, right? Before this, of course, possessing child pornography was illegal, but there was some leeway for the prosecutor to say, well, you know, let's say, okay, here's how these laws impact me and my job, right? Say you're a journalist. And let's say you're an investigative journalist and you're investigating, somebody comes to you, an informant comes to you and says, a source, and says, it's all hypothetical, of course, says there is a child pornography ring in the government, right? There are high-ranking government officials who are distributing child pornography. Now, that would be a valid thing for the press to uncover. Right? I mean, you'd have to at some point obviously also get the police involved. I'm not saying journalists shouldn't do that, but that would also be a job for the press to uncover this kind of thing. Now, to do that, let's say this informant gives you proof from a high rank. Let's say they're a high ranking. He has copied the hard drive of a high ranking political official and gives that to the journalist, right? The journalist, before writing a story saying, you know, government minister X, Y, implicated in child pornography conspiracy or whatever, you know, you'd want some proof. And you would have to, for example, if they gave you the hard drive, you check the hard drive, right? You make sure that there is a child, this pornographic material on there, that it is feasible that the person who's, let's say, laptop this was downloaded that themselves, and that this is actually a legitimate copy of, you know, that person, or could be a legitimate copy of that person's computer, for example. You'd have to do that before you publish the story. And, you know, then you might inform the police and might even give them the material if it doesn't implicate your source. I think that would be a ethical way of going about such a story as a journalist. Now, pre-2021 in Germany, it would be illegal for you as a journalist to possess this material, but there would be some leeway for the prosecutor to say, well, you know, this is not a crime because this was obtained in the person's professional, you know, in their in their position as a journalist, right? As a member of the press, they were doing their job. They were trying to ascertain if this material is real, and then they went to the police, right? So they're obviously not dealing in child pornography. They're not spreading the stuff around. They're not consuming it. They were looking at it in a professional capacity, as a journalist. And then the prosecutor could say, well, that in this case, it's not a crime. Or if the prosecutor was to prosecute this, the judge could actually, you know, decide, the judge in the case could decide, well, this is a member of the press. This is obviously not, this does not constitute a crime under the, you know, the spirit of the law, so to say. But they made away with that because under the current version of the law, possessing this material by definition is a crime, which means the prosecutor has to investigate and has to indict, and the judge has no leeway to go, well, you know, this person was meant well, right? It's like, I think, I'm not quite sure, but off the top of my head, I would say like possession of heroin, for example, or like a drug like that would be kind of the same. I think it's always a crime. Like there's no, you know, there's no like legitimate, like a way where that wouldn't be a crime. I think I could be wrong, but you know, to compare to something like this, or, you know, if you shoot somebody, there will always be an investigation. It's going to be the decision if that was like self-defense or, you know, but it's always in itself a criminal act. And this is kind of the same thing. So this does away with any, you know, let's put in air quotes, benign reason to possess child pornographic material. Now, people will say, well, how can that be? There are no, yeah, as Astro C just says in Twitch chat, extenuating circumstances, right? Yeah, that would be the English term, like the legal term. Like, you know, and somebody would say, how can there be extenuating circumstances? It's child pornography, right? And that is what the emotional parents say. And that's what then the politicians say. And they don't listen to the legal experts who told them when they passed this law, before they passed this law, lots of legal experts, including including lawyers and judges and other legal experts, said, well, if you pass a law like this, there's going to be innocent people who get caught up in this and who have their lives ruined and have to go to jail. And so the emotional people would say, well, the well-meaning people have no idea what they're talking about, would say, well, there can be no extenuating circumstances, right? Possessing this material, they don't think about journalists or other cases. I'm going to talk in a little bit about a very emblematic case of a teacher who meant well, but is now caught up in this law and will probably go to jail and lose their job. So what they did is they changed this is Article 184b Strafgesetzbuch, StGB, the criminal code of the Federal Republic of Germany, so that it's always a crime, right? And the minimum penalty is 1 year in jail. I think you could probably get that on like probation. I'm not quite sure, but I think it could theoretically happen. But, you know, you'd be ruined, right? You'd be indicted, like, no matter why, you'd be indicted as somebody who possessed child pornography, and you would be ruined. Like, you know, a journalist would be ruined in that case. And it has now taken a few years, you know, after before passing this law, the expert said this is a big mistake. But the politicians didn't listen to them. They passed the law. It's now taken a few years, but they now realized that it was a bad idea. And they're now actually working. The current government, you know, the traffic light coalition is working very quickly, very with high priority, as they say, to fix this. Now, interestingly, even the parties that from the previous government have admitted that this was a bad idea. Some of the people who have voted for it have admitted that this should tell you something, because politicians really never do this. They don't vote for a law and then 2 years later they go, well, this was really a bad idea, we should roll this back. They really never do this. It has happened in this case, which should tell you how bad this law is. As I said, they're not working. The current government's working to fix this. I personally don't know, because I'm not a legal expert. I don't understand why it's been taking months to fix this. I don't understand. So I don't understand why we can't just roll back to the previous law. Right? Even if that's not perfect, you could roll it back now to the previous law and then go, okay, we now form a, I don't know what they do, like a group, a plenary group or whatever, like a working group with experts. And, you know, we realized that this was a mistake and we still want to change that law, but we now are going to have experts tell us, you know, and deliberate and and think a bit more about how to do this. But I don't understand why they can just not roll it back. And rolling it back would be actually very important. I'm going to explain to why, but to make this as quickly as possible would be very important. So one of the reasons why they have suddenly understood that this was a very bad idea is probably some high profile cases. And I'm going to talk about one that is very emblematic about this whole thing and is a good example of extenuating circumstances or how you could possibly get into the possession of child porn material, even, you know, not talking about journalists, that's a completely different case, but how you could get in the possession of something like this and then not like actually be innocent, right? It just not having done anything bad, but you're still going to jail. And the example here, I have links to all of this. This is all in German. So if you don't speak German, I'm sorry, but there were really no English sources for this kind of stuff. But if you go to Private Citizen Press, there's a rundown of what I'm talking about, of course, and also links. So there's a case of a teacher from school in Germany. And what happened is she noticed that in her class, students, I guess male students in this case, were sharing a video of a female student. And the female student had shot a video of herself that was of pornographic nature, you know, like a sexting video that I think she sent to, you know, I don't know, I think a male student, and the male student shared it around in the classroom. Now, the teacher wanted to stop this and wanted to go to the parents of the female student that had shot this video and explain to them how bad the situation is and just get ahead of that. And what she did is very dumb, right? This is undoubtedly not a good idea, and you should never ever do this if you're a teacher. But, you know, if you think emotionally and, you know, as maybe a parent or whatever, you can see where, you know, in the heat of the moment, she did this meaning well, just doing something completely dumb and not thinking about the consequences, because she was under the impression, of course, I'm doing nothing wrong. You have to put yourself into the shoes of somebody who's like, you know, I'm doing nothing wrong, I'm just trying to help. Anyway, she got one of the male students to send her this video. And then she went to the parents of the girl and said, look, this video has been circulating. You need to talk to your daughter. We need to do something about this. And at some point, the police got involved, and obviously she had this video on her phone, and she got investigated, and she's now now on trial, facing minimum a year in jail. And of course, if she gets indicted about this, she will never be able to, even if she gets out of jail, will never ever be able to work as a teacher again, for having done nothing wrong. I mean, she immediately admitted to this. She admitted to the police that she did. She explained why. Everybody could see that she just had no bad intentions, right? That she was just trying to help. But the law and the procedure around the law that's all been changed is now such that there is no leeway. The police had to investigate. The district attorney had to indict her. And a judge will have to convict her. And both the judge and the district, and the district attorney in this case, both said they regret that they have to, trial her, like put her on trial. The district attorney didn't want to indict her, and the judge doesn't want to convict her, but they're both saying the law leaves us no choice. There's no leeway in the law. There's no provision in the law for something like this where, you know, you just got on into the possession, you know, without meaning anything. It's like making it illegal to have a gun, right? So you're walking past the bank, a bank robber who's just shot three people comes running out of the bank, sees you, gives you the murder weapon, just slaps it into your hand and runs off. and you're standing there dumbfounded, you're holding on to the gun, and the police arrests you and will now try you for murder because you're holding the gun. It's basically that kind of situation. And it is amazing that the state prosecutor and the judge are both saying, we don't want to do this, and that there's no leeway. That tells you how dumb the law is, right? That should never, ever happen. They're on, like, in the legal system, the state prosecutor is on the opposite side of the defendant, and he's basically on the side of the, or they're on the side of the defendant. So is the judge. The judge is saying, if I could, I would immediately dismiss this case and say she's innocent, but the judge can't. That's really dumb. Actually, it's so interesting. I saw a tweet it's also in German. I linked it though, from a lawyer who is talking about this, a German lawyer, and he says he knows of several cases. This is not the only case like this. Several cases where both judges and prosecutors are doing their utmost to just delay the proceedings, to table them, to, like, you know, schedule the hearing as far into the future as they can, doing whatever they can under the power of, like, you know, of what they are able to do to have bureaucratic hurdles to, like, stretch out the case, because the government has said that they're going to fix the law. And under German law, as far as I understand, it works like this. If you've been tried, if you're in front of a court, you know, if there's proceedings going on, if you're indicted, whatever, if you've been arrested, whatever, something's going on, and they've indicted you under a certain law, and this law is changed so that you under the new version of the law, you could go, like, the case would be dropped. And you haven't been, like, there hasn't been a verdict. Until there hasn't been a verdict, if the law has changed, right, even if it only goes into effect later, if the law has changed on the books, then they have to dismiss the case. So judges and prosecutors are doing their utmost to just prolonging cases so that the government, in their slow march to justice, will finally fix this law so that they can dismiss all these cases of people who've been caught up by this law who are innocent, like, or, you know, where the judge thinks they would drop the case and the prosecutor doesn't want to convict them. it's pretty amazing. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about that is when I read that, I was like, I've never seen anything like this before. I've never heard of a law like this. This is so bad. I mean, I'm laughing, but it's really, really bad. I mean, this is what happens when people who mean well, who do make emotional decisions, don't listen to the experts, you know, and don't. It's like, it's the same. I've been talking about this, like, people who quote science and treat science as a kind of religion, and they want to do what's best for society and the world based on science, but they do not understand how science works. It's kind of the same thing. They make decisions and they make laws that are really, really bad for society in the end. They mean well, but they make everything infinitely more worse, as if they'd just done nothing. And this is kind of a prime example for this, and kind of, like, really, really amazing. And it's kind of not surprising that it happens with child pornography, because that's always the first thing, as I said, you know, it's always one of the cases where this happens first, because it's always, you know, people get very emotional, they get very, very invested in doing something without thinking about it more clearly. And, you know, there's some other edge cases you could think about that, like, if you think about this, like, rationally, right, you could see how passing a law like this is, like, really, really bad. I mean, one of the other reasons, what happens if you get hacked, if somebody hacks your computer and puts this CSAM, as they like to call it, material on your, like, puts child pornography material on your computer? That was always a problem. If they then tip off the police and the police seizes your computer, you'd always be in real trouble, because like, even if you're completely innocent, you would have to prove that you didn't download this material, which is, like, really hard to do. And some, you know, maybe impossible to do. But there was at least leeway, right? You could at least, in these cases, I mean, I wouldn't expect a prosecutor to not bring this to trial because they thought you were innocent. That's not the job of the prosecutor. But the judge, in these cases, you could make a point case to the judge. You know, like, you know, this is not, like, this is really far-fetched. And, you know, I have maybe, you know, I have some data that proves that my computer was actually attacked. And then suddenly this material turns up. I mean, you'd always, don't get me wrong, even under the old situation, you'd always get in a bind. Like, you'd be in a real bind. And as somebody who's written about IT security and actually, you know, the kind of hacks where that don't, this is not something that happens to normal everyday people, but, you know, people who are really in danger of getting attacked or getting framed, like something like this was always a very, very scary possibility because it's very hard to disprove. But under the current laws, basically you're, you know, you have no chance. You're going to jail. It doesn't really matter. Unless you can like definitely prove but that would be impossible. You'd have to prove who did it, when they did it, why they did it. You know, it'd be really hard to do. And you probably would go to jail and then had to just, there had to be like a second lawsuit against, you know, basically a second criminal proceeding against the guy who did it. But at that point, you would probably already be in jail. So, you know, that's always been bad as it is. But now it's just like, you know, now it, under this law, it's like journalists cannot investigate anything. Like, as an investigative journalist in Germany right now, you cannot invest. Like, you cannot ethically write a story about, you know, investigating child pornography conspiracies or rings of people who exchange this kind of stuff, right? Because there will be no way you could make sure, ethically, as a journalist, that what you were writing about was correct, because there's no way, even if you had the proof, there's no way you could look at the proof to determine that the person you're writing about was actually doing this, because in the process of doing that, you would basically put yourself in jail. That is just like how you cannot, like, I mean, how you can pass a law like that without, like, even thinking that far, like that's really scary. I mean, to cynical people, that will not come as a surprise, but still, it just boggles the mind, I feel. Anyway, so that's what I wanted to talk about today. That you know, this is, for me, it was one of the prime examples of people meaning well, you know, being really dangerous. Goody two shoes kind of people, because, you know, meaning well is really doesn't mean anything, right? You have to actually do good, and that is a lot more work than just wanting to do good. You'd have to, you know, if you want to change laws like this, it's a lot of work. That, you know, somebody who wants to legislate will have, you know, do that in a way that's actually good for society, has to, like, very carefully examine all kinds of edge cases. It's a lot of work. You know, this is why legal specialists are paid very well, because to do something like this is painstaking work that takes a long time. And I just feel like, you know, if you're just too lazy for that and you just want to do well, but you're just doing it, something, then that is, like, really dangerous. And I'm going to a little preview to the next episode, which, you know, if my plans work out, I'll record and release next Wednesday. I'm going to talk about the European Union's chat control law, which they want to pass, you know, like sidestepping encryption, which I've talked about on the show before, but that involves, you know, looking at pictures that people have on their phones using AI and automatically sending stuff to the police. And And that in combination with laws like this is like insanely dangerous. That will just get people. People will be sent if they don't change this law first. I mean, the chat control is worth enough, but if they don't change the German law until that, if that passes, then like people will be sent to jail because an AI said something is child pornography, and then the police has to investigate, and then you know, and you know at the I think in some cases during these whole proceedings, it will actually be lost that whatever they're looking at wasn't actually child pornography. it's going to make it so much worse. And that's actually another example, you know, that's because this chat controller is another example of people meaning well, but like, you know, having... I don't. Most people involved in this legislation probably don't even mean well, but some probably do, but they have no idea. And this happens with what they're doing. This happens with technology a lot, right? People think they have to legislate something, but they really don't understand how the technology works. So they end up making the worst laws possible. Anyway, we're going to talk about that next week. That was a little preview for the upcoming episode. Now, before I wrap this up, I want to talk about a little bit of feedback that I've received while I was gone. So let's do that. I'm looking for the button. I'm looking for the button on my soundboard because I haven't done this so long that I don't know where it is. It is here. I think it is this button. Really, it's the same button I pushed earlier, but you know, I just can't do this anymore. Anyway, I always say, you know, I value feedback, and there's very much, you know. So if you have any thoughts or ideas about the things I talk about, please get in contact. Go to privatecitizen.press. All the details are on there, and we had some feedback. I mean, I think I originally talked about this feedback, but I'm going to recap it in case it's been so long anyway. So in response to episode 154, which I talked about, what did I talk about? Oh, my development server that runs the version of the website I use internally for, you know, when I prepare the show, just crashed, so I have to reload that. Where I talked about the episode was called The Democratic Delusion, where it was about, you know, people thinking that the democratic process, how we, you know, elect the government, also applies to other things in democracy. And one example I was talking about there was science, and I was talking about science. So I had a response to that episode from a listener on the forum who goes by Not Dead Just Slop, a reference to one of my favorite streamers, Deadly Slop, I feel. Anyway, Not Dead Just Slop said, "I have to say your assessment of the scientific process is incorrect. We're not going to prove a hypothesis. See it more as an evidence gathering operation. We are supposed to weighing information," obviously a scientist, Mr. Slop, "we are supposed to be weighing information gained in an experiment in the context of a hypothesis. Normally, your null hypothesis is no different between groups, usually control and treatment." Well, in medical science, I guess. "When we get a significant difference, there's evidence to reject the null hypothesis, not that our proposed hypothesis is true." So I think what he's saying is there, you know, what that tells you is not that the actual hypothesis is true, but that it is more likely than the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis could still be correct, but in this instance, the way we have approached the test, we have confidence to reject. When we continue to test a system over and over, we gather enough evidence against the null hypothesis, then we can conclude, in fact, that our proposed hypothesis is true, well, as true as anything can be in science," which is an important point. This is something that these days people don't understand. You know, there's no... I've talked about this on the show a lot. There's no absolute truth in science, right? It's as true as it can be. I view the theory of evolution in this light. While still a theory, enough evidence has been presented that I can confidently reject the null hypothesis that evolution has not occurred or is not occurring. Now, setting type 1 alpha and type 2 beta error levels is another big problem in science that needs to be discussed further. Now, I had never heard of that, so I of these error levels, so I did not understand that, so I asked him, Mr. Not That Just Slob, can you please explain what you mean by that? For some reason, the listener didn't get back to that, but another listener who writes in a lot and often, almost always, sorry, went back to German there for a bit. This is like German to red. Almost always has good feedback. Yevgeny Kuznetsov jumped in and explained. And Yevgeny says, this is long, but I'm going to read it out in full because I think it's very good and an excellent feedback post. Yevgeny says, science is ultimately about prediction. Predicting the outcome of an experiment, predicting the future, if you will. If I predict the sun sets today and rises again tomorrow, and I make that prediction based on the scientific data. You do science by observing something and figuring out whether this observation allows you to predict something you weren't able to predict before. The something is usually the result of some experiment. The very idea of a null hypothesis and the fact that this idea central to the scientific method, as we know and use it, stem from Occam's razor. As linked to Occam's razor on Wikipedia, it's also in show notes. Privacy is not press. Our default suggestion is that the thing we are observing is just a fluctuation, happened by chance and not evidence of anything important. That is, can't be used to predict anything. That default suggestion is called the null hypothesis. You then construct an experiment, usually a complicated series of experiments, to mathematically show, this usually involves hard-ass statistical methods that you need a colleague to explain to you how to even use them, let alone how they actually work under the hood. To mathematically show that your null hypothesis being correct is significantly less likely than your null hypothesis being false. Then you publish a paper making all sorts of, not entirely, unfounded claims based on that fact. Of course, your conclusion may be wrong for a number of reasons, including the fact that significantly less likely in the previous paragraph is actually almost never exactly zero chance. That's what we mean, you know, as close to the truth, as we said earlier, as close to the truth as you can. Anyway, including the fact that significantly less likely in the previous paragraph is actually almost never exactly zero chance due to how stats and math work. And your error, if indeed you are wrong, can be of two kinds. A type 1 error, also known as the alpha error, also known as false positive, is where you end up concluding that your null hypothesis was wrong while it is actually true. In fact, the thing you observed was a meaningless fluctuation, but now you're trying to make a prediction based on it, you fail in the long run. Or a type 2 error, also known as a better error or false negative, is where you end up concluding that your null hypothesis was true, while it actually is false. In fact, the thing you observed was important, but you failed to mathematically prove it, and you will not make the valid and useful predictions you could have made. I thought that this was an amazing explanation. I have to state that again. And then I gave Yevgeny a great post award on the forum for this because I think it is a great post. And the guy is not, like, English is not his native language, right? I mean, come on, this is very well written. It's very well explained to a layperson as well, which is, you know, that's what science should be, but often many scientists fail in this, and Yevgeny is great, so props. You know, credit where credit's due. He continues, the two types of error lead to different outcomes and may have very different costs in the particular field you're exploring. Consider treating patients, so Yevgeny works in a hospital, actually. He's changing careers, I think, but yeah. Consider treating patients with a non-working but harmless placebo versus erroneously discarding a potent cancer treatment that several billions of dollars have already been invested in. Then consider a possibility of not noticing a potential lethal side effect in a new vitamin pill that no one would really suffer without. Understandably, when resource limited, that is always, so true, a scientist tends to set up the experiment so that a chance of type 1 error is much less than a chance of type 2 error, or vice versa, depending on which is less expensive in the outcome terms. That's what setting tolerable error levels is essentially about. So basically what he's saying is these kinds of errors and what you are trying to achieve changes, right? The way, I mean, you can word a hypothesis in two ways. You can word it, you know, in simple, you can word it positively or you can word it negatively, right? You can, so your hypothesis being that, you know, a black hole exists and looks like this, you can word it that way, like, and you can then build your science in that respect. So you're basically trying to prove that you have an idea of what a black hole looks like and you're trying to prove that. Or you could do the opposite. You have a theory that this is what a black hole looks like and you're trying to disprove that, right? Usually you're doing the first thing, you know, when you, for example, publishing a paper because you want to doing something you know, positive, but, you know, I mean, I'm just trying to explain how you can set up your what you're basically trying to prove or disprove, and these errors change based on that. That's what he means. Like, you know, you can build experiments for if you have a new compound you're trying to develop as a drug, right? There's two different ways of doing scientific experiments about this compound when it comes to giving it to humans, right? You can try to prove that whatever this does, you know, what effect this has, right? As a drug, right? You're trying to cure some kind of disease. So you're trying to prove that. Or you could try to prove that this does not have any significant side effects. And both is valid science and both will be done probably when you're developing a drug, right? Both is important. You probably do the first, you know, probably first trying to develop this as a, you know, you figured out, you think that this solves a certain problem and you're trying to kind of, as, you know, statistically relevant, show that it does this in a significant, relevant way. And then you or other people, more often other people, will do experiments in another way where they're, you know, trying to prove that this also doesn't do any harm. And sometimes the second thing, that's what Evgeny says there in the end thing, you know, in the last paragraph. The second thing could be even more important, right? When you have said vitamin pill, it is probably more important to prove that it doesn't kill anybody than whatever it does. Like, whatever effect it has will not be that important. Right? Whereas it can also be the other way around, right? If you're trying to cure a disease that is sure to be lethal, right? We're talking about the disease that will kill everybody that has it in a year, let's say, right? Then the fact that the drug you're developing has a side effect where 20% of people take it will die is probably not as important because all the people you're giving it to will die anyway, you know? So it will still be a significantly, that drug will still improve the lives of people, even if it kills some people. It will save, like if it saves more people than it kills, and you're only giving it to people who die anyway, right? For example, there's been, there's real world examples of this. You know, some of the antivirals that been developed that came out of like trying to treat Ebola, right? Some of them had serious side effects. You would never, like, in any other scenario, you would never have a drug like that be licensed or be I'm blanking on the word here for some reason. I don't know. I need more practice podcasting, obviously. You would like the regulatory body would never say like this drug is okay to give to people in any other circumstance. But when you're talking about a disease that is, I don't know, 80%, 90% lethal, right? And you're talking about very few people who get this disease, but you know, if they get it, they're pretty much dead. You get a lot more leeway with giving them drugs that have serious long-term side effects, right? Because I mean, if they save their lives in the first place, you know, if the side effect is like, you know, you'll need a new liver afterwards, right? Then you know, a doctor will go, right, but we saved this person's life. Let's first save their life, and then we'll deal with, you know, getting them a new liver, whatever, right? Or them having to live without, I don't know, you know, or, you know, serious lung damage or whatever. You know, it's kind of, that's very important. Like, and that's not only like in medical science. I think this is, I'm trying to feel what Not That Just Slop was saying about, but I think this is a very important point. It's a very interesting point about science, right? Because it's also a nuance a lot of people don't understand. It's not like the scientific method works like this and it always works like this. It depends very much on what you are looking at, like what you're trying to research, what you're trying to... Science is, in the end, you know, you're trying to find out a truth about something. You can never get to the absolute perfect truth in most cases, but you're trying to get as close to the truth as possible, right? Whether it's how the universe works, you know, how stars are formed, you know, what happens to a star when it dies, or whether you're trying to research a certain compound and what it does to the human body, or you're trying to research how, you know, certain cells develop into tumors or whatever. You're basically trying to figure out how the world works, the universe works. You're trying to get close to the truth. But to do that, you have to work with, you're observing something, and then you have to, you know, you're observing something, and then you have to kind of try to decide what that means. Then you have to formulate a theory, and then you have to try to design experiments that test your theory, right? And as we've learned, you know, basically against the null hypothesis, which just means you're trying to figure out if your theory is more likely than something else. Like, is this more likely than whatever I observed, right? Is this actually something significant that gets me closer to the truth, or is it something that happens because of pure chance, right? And that will be, whereas, you know, if you look at a picture that you took through a microscope, and you're like, okay, this cell looks like this. Is that just a random mutation, or is that because there is a disease at work, right? Or you're trying to figure out what happens, like why can I not see, you know, for example, if you have a if you look at the cosmos, right, and you're looking at the stars and light that comes into your telescope, like why can I not see these stars, right? Is there's something in the way, but why can't I see it? Like why is there, like is that a dust cloud? Is it dark matter? Is it a black hole? You know, those kinds of things. You're observing something, and then you develop a theory. And, you know, you can also do this without observing anything. That's like theoretical physics is a lot of that. Or like philosophy, right? If done right, is also a science. But you're using the same tools, basically, you know, the same way to build hypotheses and to test it. But you're testing it differently, right? You don't have empiric data. You're trying to doing that with pure logic, basically. And often, like in something like theoretical physics, that's often the first step. And then other people develop actual ways of gathering data. And then, you know, your hypothesis will become closer to, you know, being validated, because now a black hole is not simply an idea you've come up with pure logic. It's also an explanation for something you can observe. And like, that's one of the problems I always have, for example, with people doing science based on computer models. I don't think that is in itself bad, because basically, as Yevgeny explained, a lot of science is just statistics, and computers are really good at statistics. So, feeding lots of data into a statistical model in a computer and trying to come up with basically predicting the future, which is what all science is, as Yevgeny has explained, or most of it is, I think, you're trying to, maybe not historical science, I don't know, but you know, you can do that. The problem I often have is that the when it's not done correctly, the people who do it, I mean, a computer model is always built by a human, right? And you have to factor that in. So the guy who builds the model builds biases into the model. And I think the problem is also not as often not the scientists doing this, because, you know, speaking, for example, about climate change, when, you know, lots of the supporting evidence is based on computer models, the scientists that do that often understand the limitations and they put that in the paper. The people who do not understand that are the people who are writing about this in the press, or activists or politicians who make laws, as we've seen today, right? You know, they mean well, but they don't understand what they're doing, really. So they don't understand the limitations. They go, well, this computer model proves. Well, not really. You know, it's trying to disprove the null hypothesis, and it also has severe limitations, which are listed in this paper, you know, but that is often overlooked. So, I think often the problem, most of the time, is not the scientists. Most scientists do their job pretty well. I mean, there's problems in science also, you know, there's pressure to have a lot of publications. And there's often these days people just publish any old crap just to have a publication. But, you know, that is a relatively minor problem, I think. I think in general, scientists do a lot of work, and they do a lot of good work, and they're so meticulous about their field that they often, understand the limitations of what they're doing, and they're very direct and very straightforward with explaining that to people. It's often the people whose job it is to interpret this for, like, the layperson, like people like me, journalists, right? Who do a bad job of explaining it, which then leads to people like politicians who can't read the scientific paper because they are not trained for that. They are, in some cases, I think, not intelligent enough to do it. They will have to fall back to people explaining this in lay terms, and they often make mistakes, right? And this is how we come to things like people saying, you know, 98% of scientists agree, which is, in anybody who does science, this is a meaningless statement, right? Because that's not what science is about. Science is about always challenging exactly that, right? There's different kinds of science. You can do science in a very basic fundamental level. For example, stuff that my wife does is basically researching, and lots of scientists do this, especially like in medical science, stuff like that. You're researching something that is just completely not understood. Like, you know, somebody will discover a new cell type, and then you're researching what do these cells do. So then you are just like, you're just out in the space, the final frontier, right? Nobody, no man has gone here before, and you're the first person or woman, you're the first human to go, well, what does this mean? And then that's also, like, you know, it's always the cutting edge of science. That's if you're Oppenheimer and you're building the first nuclear bomb, you're like, I don't know. We don't actually, you know, the general asks you what could happen. So, I mean, we could destroy the world, right? How high is the chance? Well, it's statistically not very likely. Yeah, but you know, that is one type of science, but there's also like lots of that. Lots of science is just being the second guy who goes, you know, I don't think the prevailing 98% are right, you know. Something like, you know, the theory of evolution. People had lots of theories where how animals developed, and Darwin was like, I don't think this is, no, I think this is how it works. And for a very long time, people said, you know, that's crazy, or, you know, black holes. There were experts in the field said this is idiocy, it's crazy. And I don't know if I've talked about this on a podcast before, but if you haven't seen Oppenheimer, the movie, Nolan's Oppenheimer, it's an excellent movie. It's very long. It's very dry. It's more like it's a biopic, right? It's more like it's not an action packed suspense movie. But it's if you have a interest in science, it's very interesting. And there's an excellent scene in there where you know, they're all in the laboratory in the morning, and somebody brings in a paper, and the paper says the Germans have split the atom. And they're reading the paper and they're going like, this can't be right. And so the news is that I think Heisenberg or whatever, like the German research group has managed to bombard an atom with neutrons and, you know, split the atom. And Oppenheimer goes, they must be wrong. Like the journalists have this wrong. Somebody or the Germans are lying. Something's wrong. And he goes to a blackboard. And then there's a cut. And then it's like 20 minutes later, the blackboard is like completely covered. And Oppenheimer goes to like his colleague and says, look, I have a really well thought out like theoretical explanation of why you cannot split an atom by bombarding it with neutrons. And he's just like going to explain it when somebody runs in from next door and says, well, you are wrong because Joe over here, they have like so Oppenheimer is like the theoretical department. They have like the guy with the cyclotron next door. I forgot what his name is. This guy, like, he just did it. And they go over and they look at it, and Oppenheimer, they have like an oscilloscope, and Oppenheimer's like, oh, okay. So like the 20 minutes I just did is just like, okay, I guess that's obsolete now. And that's like a very good encapsulation of how like science works, both on a theoretical level as well as actually being a scientist. Usually it doesn't take 20 minutes. It's more like 20 years. Like you work on something for 20 years and then somebody, you convince, and everybody's convinced this is how it is. This is like the truth. And then some guy comes along and says, no, actually, we did this, and we think it's like that. And then everybody goes, oh, okay. So this, like, there's this falsity of thinking that lots of people fall into these days, that, you know, first there's an absolute truth, and science job, like, lots of people think science is like a body of knowledge. It's like the book of knowledge that you can consult, and then you're like, oh, I want to know this. And then you can go to the scientists whose job it is to figure out the truth and then write it in a book. Whereas, as you know, Yevgeny explained very well how it actually works, is a process. It's always a process to find something that approaches the truth. And, you know, and sometimes somebody comes along and changes everything. Sometimes it doesn't, like, you know, the Watson and Crick model of DNA has held up. Like, the closer and closer we get with new microscopes to actually look at DNA, the more it looks like it actually looks like this. Which is amazing. Like, if that comes out, that if at some point we have a microscope where you can actually look at the molecules and they actually look like the model we have right now, that would be amazing, because those guys, or actually the woman who came up with it that Watson Crick stole it from, just did that theoretically, right? That's that's just a theoretical model, but it held up so far to everything people have, you know, have thrown against it. And yeah, sometimes it works like this, you know, like, or it's like the theory of evolution, where like the more we learn, the more plausible it actually is, where it's now at a point where you can confidently say, I think that's how it works. But the crucial thing is always ask the next question. We've talked about this on the podcast before, which is basically have an open mind. You always have to have an open mind. Yes, this is how evolution works. We're pretty sure it is. But if somebody comes along and says, no, it's not, here's a better theory, you can't just go, well, you're an idiot. You know, go away. This is science. This is how it works. That's not how it works. Anyway, I thought that was a great, great, great explanation by Evgeny. Thanks for jumping in and doing that. And before I wrap up the show, I just want to give a hint to maybe there was another nice feedback post from Mike, which was also relatively long. I'm not going to read this out, but the thread's very interesting. So Mike Jensen, you know him. He was on the show before. Maybe he'll be on the show again. I would hope if he ever wants to. Mike, give me a call. He's very busy. I certainly know the feeling. That's, I think, mostly the problem. And probably he's given me a book to read as homework when I met him in Copenhagen earlier this year for a Sabaton concert. And I haven't read it yet. So he probably wants me to read that book, which is fair enough. Anyway, there's a good thread. I put a link in the show notes as well, Private Citizen Press, where it's feedback thread to episode 156. Which is obviously the previous episode, the widening gyre, and it's just about general things. You know, Mike talked about journalism, gave me some feedback on journalism on the book I have to read. He linked an article that I'll also have to read. So he's basically, one of the things he brought up was that I always talk about bad examples in journalism. And he would like to have some good examples from good investigative journalists, and not only Greenwald and Taibbi, he says. And I would love that too. I'm a bit resource constrained. I think I already have enough on my plate looking at the bad stuff, basically. So if you have good examples of good investigative journalism, like really good examples of good journalism, maybe from your neck of the woods or whatever, please feel free to send them in. Like, you know, go to Private Citizen Press or go on the forum, forum.fab.industries. It's also linked on the site. And let me know. Send me an email. Use the anonymous contact form if you want. I'd be interested. It's not that I don't want to talk about it. I've got so much on my plate and so many topics to cover as it is that right now I don't have the resources for it, but I would love to do it. So that's the feedback. Please, if you have anything to say on this show or any opinions on this show or on the feedback, we often have feedback on the feedback. I'm all happy to read it. If you want me to read it out, I might read it out. If you want me to keep it anonymous, just let me know. I will honor that, of course. And yeah, we'll see. We'll see what people what you have to say about this episode. And with that, let's wrap it up. This is the point of the show where I would like to thank everybody who's been supporting me, especially right now, because, you know, I haven't put episodes out for quite a while. And people are still supporting me, and I love that. So people are members of my Patreon, and they, you know, there's various ways of contributing every month to keep the show running. And I'm honored that people do that, even though I've been slacking recently. So thanks a lot to my showrunner Sol Galtarin, who's doing a huge part keeping the show on the road. Also my executive producers Butterbeans, Jaroslav Lichtblau, Rizel, and Sandman 616. Many thanks to my supervising producers, Avis, Bennett Piata, Dave, IKN, Jacob Lage, Jonathan, Jonathan M. Hetai, Krunkel, Michael Malen Jensen, and Tobias Weber, or Tobias Weber, maybe. Also, thanks to my producers, Andrew Davidson, Astral C, Barry Williams, Cam, Captain Aircat, Dirk Didi, Fadi Mansour, Florian Pigosch, Joe Poser, Mr. Amish, RJ Tracy, and Robert Forster. Thanks to my associate producers, D, Jonathan, Yuan Sonin, Kai Sears, Ricky M, Steve Hose, and Vlad. And also to Eric Lelay, who provided additional support. You can also support me by using PayPal if you want to. I don't have the details on the website, but if you get in contact, we can sort that out. I mean, you can just PayPal to producers@fab.industries if you want. If you don't want to commit to a monthly thing. If you want to do anything else, send me beer or a check. People have threatened to do that because I've never cashed a check in my life. I don't even know how that works. Please let me know. You know, contact, go to Private Citizen or Press. We can work something out. I also have to thank Bytemark at bytemark.co.uk, a great British cloud hosting company who provides the service and the bandwidth for this podcast. Couldn't do it without them. So thanks to Bytemark. And that's it. I'm going to play us out with a song called Cumbia Pirata. My Spanish is not very good, so I apologize if I butchered that. Cumbia Pirata, it sounds like a pirate song. By Frontera Bugalú. Bugalú? Frontera Bugalú? I hope I didn't completely butcher that. Anyway, I thought it was a nice song, so... you know, and I dig the pirate connection. I've been watching One Piece on Netflix. Yeah, I know it's not the original anime, but I'm having fun with it. So I kind of like the pirate connection right now. And yeah, I'll see you next week, hopefully, for another episode. Everything goes according to plan. Until then, stay free and aim to misbehave.
Alegres que los vientos van soplando. Viajero y cumbianchero, el acordeón es mi idioma. En cada puerto que llego, las mujeres se enamoran. A mí eso no me importa, mi deseo tiene otra forma. Las cumbias que yo compongo son materia de otra cosa. Corazón anclado, anclado en tu querer. Un barco encallado que no puede volver. Por las noches veo la luna, me mira suspirando. Anhelo esos momentos en que estoy a tu lado. Nacemos con el derecho de ser parte de un poblado. A muchos ese sueño se nos ha negado. Solo queda seguir cantando, tomando y fumando, gozando, bailando.